when we look at observational and longitudinal studies, we do see this protective effects of diet, fiber-rich diets, and prebiotic-rich foods on cognition later in life. But we are not really able to establish that when it comes to acute interventions, even if they are 2 years' time or 4 weeks or 12 weeks or so on.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Eamon Quigley and Dr. Gabrielle Bingerola.
Hello there, and welcome to the latest edition of the ISAP podcast series, Science, Microbes and Health. My name is Eamon Quigley, and it's a great pleasure for me today to co-host this session.
Hello, my name is Gabriel Binderola from Argentina, and I'm also very, very happy to be today co-hosting this episode.
We have a wonderful episode for you today with a special guest, Dr. Bushra Dalile, who's a postdoctoral researcher at KU Leuven in Belgium. She trained actually in psychology in Australia and in cognitive neuroscience in Sweden and at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, before being awarded a PhD in biomedical sciences at the Translational Research Center for Gastrointestinal Disorders in Leuven under our good friend, Professor Christian Verbeek. Since her PhD, she's been investigating the effects of dietary fiber and the role of short-chain fatty acids on stress and anxiety, and is currently mapping out their putative mechanisms of action in humans. And this indeed will be our topic for today, the role of prebiotics and short-chain fatty acids in cognitive function. Welcome, Bushra. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, to start us off, could you give us a brief overview of your area of research and what you're working on at the moment?
Yes. So I've been looking into prebiotics and short-chain fatty acids since the beginning of my PhD back in 2017. And at the time, there were quite a few animal studies and only a few human studies that have suggested that prebiotics could have an effect on human psychobiology. So by this, I mean mood, emotion, and cognition. And what we wanted to do at the time, given the fact that the short-chain fatty acids are known to be the main mediating mechanisms for the effects of prebiotics, is to really investigate that directly in humans. So to establish whether this is indeed a mechanism of action and how far-reaching of effect it can have. And so what we have done then is to target them directly by taking capsules, filling those short-chain fatty acids in those capsules, and coating them in such a way that they would bypass the entire gastrointestinal tract until they reach the colon and presumably exert their effects on systemically as well as on the brain. And so the area that I've been focused on mostly is looking at whether these SCFAs can influence stress and anxiety-related processes. And I've done that over multiple clinical trials, and now we continue to look at their effects and their mechanisms of actions in humans.
Bushra, I've been taking a look to your very, very nice production. You've been working with adults, and we know that this cognitive function in children is really important in the first year of life. Do you think that you will ever direct your research also to children? I think it should be much more challenging.
Absolutely. I think there are scholars out there who are looking at, for instance, the microbiome and child development, as well as cognition. But this is not something I am doing at the moment. It is actually, indeed, I am interested in the adult population because it is in a sort of homogenous state of development. And from the research that I have done so far, it is quite difficult to even assert that homogeneity because there are many impacting the microbiome, impacting cognition as well. So I prefer for myself to figure that out a bit further before myself going into areas of development and also old age, which has this implication as well.
Exactly. And that's where I want to come in. And of course, I have to declare a degree of self-interest here, given my own age. But I'm particularly interested in what happens later in life, when perhaps the microbiome is changing and perhaps even, some would say, deteriorating. And of course, you see more impacts in terms of cognition, memory loss, etc. So is that an area that you're currently studying or plan to study?
It's interesting what you're saying. I think we know that this deterioration in cognition does not start later in life, but actually 20 or 30 years before the first symptoms appear. So myself...
Make it even worse.
I think opportunity for targeting prevention rather than curing. And I think this is something that we are currently missing in the field. So I'm going to try to make this point in two ways. One is that when we look at observational and longitudinal studies, we do see this protective effects of diet, fiber-rich diets, and prebiotic-rich foods on cognition later in life. But we are not really able to establish that when it comes to acute interventions, even if they are 2 years' time or 4 weeks or 12 weeks or so on. So I think this is myself, together with other experts in the field, we're actually writing a prospective article on this issue where we are urging other scholars to target what we call cognitive resilience rather than curing cognition after it has been impaired in cases of mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So I think this is what brings me back to then still studying the adult or like young adult to middle age population, because that is the time point where prevention can start to take place for later in life.
And Bursa, can you tell us a little bit more, how do you perform a clinical study where you will put people into stress? What do you give? What do you measure? How do they get stressed, anxious?
Yeah. So there are, I think most of the research within the nutrition field tends to focus on symptom reporting. So asking people how stressed they are feeling. And as a psychologist, we know that that is not always accurate because there are social desirability effects. People want to say they are better for the sake of the experimenter. Yeah. They also have some retrospective bias. So they might overestimate or underestimate their stress levels. So what we do in the lab, at least in the context of my studies, is actually put participants under stressful situations that have in some research been associated with real life stressors. But the difference is that it is in a controlled setting. So we have full control. Everybody is exposed to the same procedure. Of course, they will react somewhat differently. And we expect that the effects of the intervention, be it prebiotics or short chain fatty acids, would induce an effect that is beyond the existing variability in stress responses. So one of the tasks that we use in the research that I'm doing is called the Maastricht Acute Stress Test. It is basically, for instance, what might be stressful to you, Gabriel, is different than what is stressful to me. And the uniqueness about this task is that it combines multiple components of stress to promote as robust as possible reactivity of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is one of the major stress systems. So what we do is we have the participants immerse their hands in ice cold water, which is a form of physical stress. Yes, I'm sorry, okay. For starting.
No, it's so interesting. Yeah.
That induces physical stress or pain. And at the same time, they have to alternate doing that with performing mental arithmetic. So we ask them to calculate, for instance, backwards in steps of 17 or 13 from 2034. And we give them also, so this is mental stressor. And then we add to that the social aspect, which is actually the most important aspect when it comes to increasing the stress hormone cortisol in the system. And how we do that is by giving them negative feedback and telling them that they're not doing well and being quite unempathic. So for instance, if they are calculating slowly, we tell them you have to speed up. Other people are doing better than you. If they make mistakes, yes, we have to tell them that you need to be faster, you need to calculate as accurately as possible, and so on. So it's time sensitive as well. And it gives, which is really important, the sense of unpredictability and uncontrollability for the participant. And these two aspects are really important because we are all exposed to certain stressors. But when it becomes unpredictable, when we know that we don't have enough coping resources to overcome it, that is when it becomes bad stress or distress in a way. And so this is how we induce that. And then we enter to the equation the intervention of interest, the diet-related intervention of interest or the microbiome-related. And we could also, which is one of the things that is ongoing in my current work, is we induce stress and that has effects that lasts for, in terms of cortisol, for instance, an hour time. And we follow that up with cognitive tasks. So we, for instance, look at executive functioning, so the ability to plan and execute certain behavior to reach a certain goal. And we see whether, well, we know that stress impairs that aspect of cognition. And we want to see if the addition of prebiotics or short-chain fatty acids in this sense can mitigate this impairment, basically. So this is a snapshot.
You know, one of the things I've learned from reading about stress is that chronic stress has quite different effects to acute stress. And chronic stress, in the context that you're studying, may be more deleterious than an acute stress. So, but of course, it's much more difficult to study. Like, you can't keep people under stress for 3 weeks or a month or whatever it is. So I'd like you just to comment about the implications of your work for chronic stress and how that might tie into cognitive impairment and decline over time.
Yes, this is a very good question, because indeed it's one of the challenges in research that we are not allowed to induce chronic stress. So one of the things that other researchers do is, for instance, recruit populations where chronic stress is present, like caregivers, nurses, emergency doctors, and so on. And I think in terms of what I was talking about with acute stress and cognition, for instance, there are indeed studies that have shown that acute stress can enhance certain aspects of cognition and impair others. So that nuance is also quite important. So in the current ongoing trial that we are doing, we are actually putting in, for instance, three cognitive tasks that we know should be impaired. And we also have a control of a task that should not be impaired or even slightly enhanced under stress as a sort of control. And in relation to what you were asking about dementia and Alzheimer's, that is quite difficult, because we know that the evidence there are primarily prospective and associative in nature, because again, yes, chronic stress cannot be induced. So nevertheless, certain aspects of executive function, learning, and memory is impaired under chronic stress. And that maybe has implications on the length of dietary intervention, prebiotic intake, and adhering to healthy diets for prolonged period of times to make us resilient against this chronic stressor that is, in some cases, uncontrollable, right, in life. So I think also this is where prebiotics can have potential in being investigated as promoting cognitive resilience.
I had one more question, then I'm going to hand over to Gabrielle. So one of the questions that always comes up when we discuss microbiome gut-brain axis is how exactly a luminal signal, be it from a probiotic or a prebiotic or a short-chain fatty acid, how it actually reaches the brain. Mm-hmm. And that's the question I'm going to pose to you.
Yes, I think we have been making great strides in terms of understanding these bidirectional mechanisms. However, I think we remain still in the preclinical sphere, in the sense that the physiology and anatomy of rats and mice are fundamentally different to humans, but we can draw a lot on these evidence of the mechanisms that have been investigated there to translate them to humans, which is actually something that we're currently working on. So when it comes to prebiotics and short-chain fatty acids, there are a variety of pathways at play, including the fact that they have been shown in preclinical studies to lower systemic inflammation, but also to protect against certain insults that increase both systemic inflammation and neuroinflammation. And since we've been talking about Alzheimer's and dementia, neuroinflammation is a critical mechanism there. We also understand more and more, again, based on preclinical studies, how short-chain fatty acids can signal to the brain via the vagus nerve, for instance, through the presence of their receptors on the vagus nerve and stimulating vagal afferents in general into the nodose ganglia and then the brainstem and so on. I think when it comes to cognition, one of the most important mechanisms of action, which I'm also currently working on, is related to epigenetics. So short-chain fatty acids, particularly butyrate, act as histone deacetylase inhibitors. And this means that, so we have the DNA strands, which are wrapped around histone proteins, and the coiling and uncoiling of the DNA strands is controlled by certain enzymes, one of which is called histone deacetylases. And this has implications on the relaxation and the repression of the DNA, and therefore gene transcription and expression. And what butyrate does, along with propionate and acetate, is inhibit those enzymes and result in a more relaxed chromatin structure and then promoting gene expression. So in this way, it has been shown in animals that it can promote memory and plasticity-related genes. And in one of my current ongoing clinical trials, we're also looking into that. So we're trying to see whether it can enhance certain aspects of threat-related memory processing that is relevant to stress and anxiety. So there are many different mechanisms of action, and I think currently we are not able to investigate all of them in humans, but those including epigenetics, inflammation, and neuroinflammation can be investigated using, for instance, state-of-the-art neuroimaging and inflammation models or endotoxin models, for instance. So a lot of work still to come, but really important, I think, because the preclinical state of the evidence is quite encouraging, but it still requires translation before we can take it a step further to patients and vulnerable population.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Fantastic. Bushra, when a fiber gets into the gut and it's fermented by the whole community, it's not only short chain fatty acid. There are many other metabolites that are produced at the same time. And I saw that you did a study with BRAM on one side, and then another study with short chain fatty acid. Do you think that you can see difference if people get the whole fiber all directly, the short chain fat? Are we missing something if we are giving only short-chain fatty acids?
That's a very good question. I have myself, even in that wheat bran study, not looked at other metabolites, unfortunately. So that would be a limitation. But we know that fiber-rich or prebiotic-rich foods are rich in other nutrients and molecules that are important for brain function. So I guess it depends on what we are trying to address with this question. Are we trying to establish the extent to which short-chain fatty acid production from this fiber or prebiotic is important, or are we trying to talk about the whole matrix of the certain food that we are administering? So what we saw, for instance, in that wheat bran study is that although statistically significantly there was an increase in short-chain fatty acids in the blood, this was actually much lower in magnitude relative to the administration of short-chain fatty acids themselves. Yes. And that could be, of course, due to the type of fiber wheat bran. We tried to make it more fermentable, but in the end, it still cannot reach as high levels as we, I guess, were hoping for to replicate the capsule study that you were referring to. And I think this is important because, again, drawing on the preclinical field in general, the amounts of fiber or prebiotics that are administered are much higher relative to the animal's, let's say, body weight and physiology than that administered to humans. So I think in general, there should be more human studies, of course, or there should be preclinical studies that sort of try to match the dose with what would be physiologically relevant for human participants and patients. Yes.
So this is, you mentioned actually a very important point, this disparity between doses that are possible in animals relative to body weight and are possible in humans. It's an issue for probiotic studies, prebiotic studies, you name it, it's an issue across the board. I just want to ask you one other question about on the short-chain fatty acids. Have you observed or would you postulate a hierarchy among short-chain fatty acids? For example, butyrate is often regarded as maybe the most anti-inflammatory, et cetera, et cetera. In your studies, do you notice any significant differences between the various short-chain fatty acids, are they all much of a muchness?
Yeah, this is a really important question, and it's something that we are taking with us forward from some of the, let's say, secondary observations that we are deriving from our data. So currently, I have looked at, for instance, stress and anxiety, and I've looked at anxiety from an associative learning perspective. And actually, when you look at the data that is related to stress and cortisol, it seems that propionate is more relevant for that type of process relative to butyrate and acetate. And when you look at anxiety-related learning and memory and retrieval of the anxiety-related memory, you see that butyrate may be playing a more prominent role. I cannot say this with absolute certainty because it's like derived from associations when pooling these clinical trials together, and I'm hoping we will publish on that soon. But we are taking those observations to help us design those future clinical trials. We still need to make sure that they can be causally established. So in one of the future clinical trials, we're hoping, for instance, to administer propionate on its own to see if it can account for the stress-related effects. And in one of my current projects, I'm looking at butyrate in relation to retrieval of safety memory, which is very relevant to anxiety disorders. So there is some hierarchy, although when you look at the preclinical literature, sometimes, which I find quite unfortunate, is that there's not always a clear rationale for using a mixture of short-chain fatty acids versus propionate alone versus butyrate alone. My guess is that most of the time it's just relying on some observation from the past or on convenience, but it's not possible to say that propionate, for instance, does not have effects on immunity, because it does. But they have not really been compared head to head to see the magnitude of those effects, which I think would be really cool to better guide human research going forward.
And if we have to think in a situation of real life, for example, the acute stress you're studying in the lab can be similar to the stress that it will have if I have to take a plane, I have to give a conference. How far are we from making a translation to say, okay, get 7 days of short-chain fatty acid if you are going to travel? Are we far? How far, how close are we from that application?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. What we know, for instance, from these laboratory studies outside of the field of prebiotics or the microbiota, is that the healthy individual or adult's response to these acute stressors in the lab is predictive of their, for instance, cardiovascular health 15 or 20 years later. So there is an element of ecological validity to what we are doing. In relation to an intervention or for how long I should be taking a prebiotic or in which dose, I think we're a little bit far of knowing exactly that. And the recommendation remains that we should be adopting healthy diets for a prolonged period of time, because that is actually where we are seeing the effects, where we are seeing the prospective effect. One interesting thing that we found in our study, or from pooling the data across these clinical trials, is that also the amount of short-chain fatty acids that is found in the blood is related to the reactivity to stress. So those people, for instance, that have higher SCFAs, particularly propionates, tend to have a lower cortisol response. And that could have the implication that there needs to be sufficient amounts in the blood to be protective against a stressor when it comes up, regardless of an intervention. So for me, my own advice to myself, or what I try to live by, is to eat sufficient amounts of dietary fiber per day, fruits, vegetables, also varied types, of course, because of the needs of the microbiome itself, as well as the fact that different fibers will produce different amounts of SCFAs and so on. So yeah.
In general, the population is missing a lot of fiber. I think most people is below the daily recommendation, right?
Correct. Yes. We know, for instance, in Belgium, where I am, is that the average intake of dietary fiber is about 18 grams per day, when the recommendation is, let's say, 28 to 32 for men, women, and so on. So we are falling behind. And if I am correct, there is not really an upper limit to how much fiber you should eat. Of course, it can cause some discomfort, but that can be in healthy population, you can get used to that and also consume sufficient amount of water while consuming those foods. But we know that in certain populations in the world, this can go up to 50 grams. And I think there's research also on certain populations that have taken up to 100 grams per day. So we are definitely lower than what we need to consume. And I think, yeah, that is a recommendation, regardless of the implications on the brain, that is also for general health quite important.
So can I take you up on that? That's a very interesting point. So as you know, there were many studies in the past which looked at the relation between dietary fiber in various populations, such as in rural Africa, et cetera, and the incidence of appendicitis, diverticulitis, gallstones, et cetera. Now, I know there are lots of problems because of different aging of populations, et cetera, but have there been studies looking at the relationship between dietary fiber intake and cognitive decline in later life?
Yes. Let me just try to recall. Those are, we do know that greater intake of dietary fiber is associated with lower risk of dementia. So there are some studies, I think this is one study that was done in Japan, for instance. There are not so many of them and definitely not super long in terms of the follow-up period.
Yeah, but they're very difficult to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because there are lots of confounders and you have to match populations, et cetera, so it's very difficult. But that's an intriguing aspect to all of this, is that that probably is the real world translation.
Absolutely. And it remains super important. And I hope we can get more data on that. But we do have these associations present in relation not only to cognition, but also to depression and anxiety as well. Although we should keep in mind that the effect sizes that are found, how much variability is explained by dietary fiber intake with respect to variation in anxiety and depression and cognition is not really that high. It fluctuates, I would say, between 5% to maximally like 20%.
I want to give the last word to you, Bushra, and I want you to tell us where you're going next with this research. What are the really important questions you want to address?
I think one of them is really related to prevention. I would really like to see if at the laboratory level, with studying the hypothesized mechanisms in humans, whether we can protect cognition, protect lower mood and increased stress reactivity with short-chain fatty acids and with prebiotics. I am also currently, as I said, looking at learning and memory in relation to anxiety. So I'm focused on fear conditioning and butyrate specifically, because I think that anxiety is something very close to my heart. And the current therapies that are available are not having as high chance of a success, even though they are very good, but they do need to be supplemented with something in addition to make them work better. So currently my focus is on looking at butyrate in the context of exposure therapy in the lab, but also hopefully later with patients, and uncovering the mechanisms of action and seeing how far this can be taken, basically.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. So, and before I finish, we must remember that you're a Glenn Gibson Award recipient as well, which is a great honor. On behalf of Gabrielle and myself and all at ICEP, I would like to really thank you for joining us today for what I think has been a fascinating conversation. We're really intrigued by your work and we look forward to seeing a lot more in the future and hope to talk to you again and get an update on where your work is going. Thank you very much for being with us, Bush.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ICEP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isepscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.